This is tape 4, side 2 of The Impersonal Actor. The face. Mostly, as we have been encouraged to portray emotion as actors rather than to accurately communicate, we often have a tendency to use our faces as an emotional register. But it's not quite that way in life. If you look carefully, you'll see that the amount of facial communication in the human experience is conversely related to the gravity of a given situation. The more serious the circumstance, the less facial communication. Primarily, it is vocal communication, which is our way and method of exchange, except in the deaf community for obvious reasons, and that more often than not our face is used as a means of furthering concepts in humor, and that in regard to things which are less than profound in their implications. That is to say, we humans are much more likely to use facial expression as a means of communication when we are, for example, talking about something that smelled bad as opposed to talking about something that is bad. Somewhere in our humanity, we have determined that overt facial expression lessens rather than heightens the implications of a communication. Very often dramatic work, which is unsubtle and overdone, is so simply because the actor has matched the face to the communication. It is not usual, for example, that an angry face matches an angry voice. In fact, you'll see that in life, our most passionate communiques are often delivered out of a remarkably expressionless face, and that what is often untruthful work in acting is merely the inclusion of too much facial emotion, which does not read true to life. Very often, this is the result of note after note given an actor relentlessly demanding to see his emotions. It's not only enough, but it is imperative in good acting that an audience looking through the keyhole more perceive what a character's emotions are rather than to see them. Think of the last time someone communicated to you that they were sorry for something, whether they were apologizing or commiserating, and if they used anything more than a minimal inclusion of facial expression, you weren't so sure, were you? This is because it's too much. It's more than true. It isn't how we are. Because the truth of our communications is contained in the vocal aspect, and if anything more than functional and resultant face is included, it literally appears to be a put-on. Have you ever been complimented and noticed that something was wrong or just off about the compliment? If you'd had a tape recording of the compliment, you would have probably heard a rather genuine compliment. But when you see a complimenting face along with a complimenting vocal communication, it's too much. It's doubtful. It's perceived as possibly insincere, unless it's in a noisy room in which it's difficult to audibly communicate. In other words, the high school principal may make a great face of concern for the purpose of chiding a student body into better attendance and higher grades. But the communication is likely to be almost entirely verbal with little if any facial participation if he's addressing campus violence. Too much facial expression is a giveaway to less than desirable acting technique, and the minute you master its secondary place in human communication, your work will immediately become much more truthful. You'll also find that in many scripts are very passionate moments which before you simply could not get to work because they always seem so overdone. By removing face and passionately communicating verbally, you'll suddenly find what the writer knew all along, that there was nothing unreal about the moment, but that it had seemed overdone. Thus, you'll no longer have a tendency to pull back from very full moments for fear of overacting, for your full moments will then be true to human behavior. Ingrid Bergman said, "In Casablanca, there was often nothing in my face, but the audience put in my face what they thought I was giving." Over-enunciation is something which should be done only if your character is doing it for effect, usually when he's convincing someone or making a joke of some kind. What you really want to do as an actor is to become a master at mumbling. And you can do this by becoming an expert at seeing in material what is to be gotten through and what is to be featured in a communication. If you have a long thought, get to the good part, get to the point. We will look at this process now by becoming familiar with little a, big B. Little a, big B is a tool to use in understanding moments that are basically constructed of two thoughts, the first of which is relatively unimportant, being an opinion or observation or a joke, and the second being germane and of use. While these moments have a tendency to occur more visibly in comedy than in drama, you should be looking for them just as much in both kinds of writing. Your dog makes you go for a walk in a rainstorm, and a car with a young couple comes to a stop quickly next to you on the curb. The young man rolls down his window and asks you where the nearest hospital is. His wife's about to have a baby. Your character has the line, "You picked a hell of a day, period. Go down to the corner, take a right, it's 1 mile." You would recognize that because of the critical circumstances, for you to take time with the first part of that line is both extremely inconsiderate and just not truthful. In other words, to take time saying, "You picked a hell of a day," is to choose caricature over circumstance. Then it follows that little a, or the words, "You picked a hell of a day," is a secondary comment to the primary communication, which is the directions to the hospital. The actor correctly delivers the line in a way consistent with his character's being immediately preoccupied with the directions he's about to give, and so quickly mumbling little a and then unmistakably featuring big B. That is to say, something like, "Picked a hell of a day, go down to the corner, take a right, it's 1 mile. You'll find that a pretty fair number of moments consists of little a and big B, and a mastery of them is fundamental to clear acting. These moments are usually ironic observations in drama and understated one-liners in comedy. They are a basic element in witty exchanges, for they occur in limbo time without losing sight of the circumstances and are usually communicated while the character is preoccupied with the main event. In little a, big B, the little a is said while preparing to communicate big B. And that's how it's done. Simple as that. Look for it. In 1949, critic Robert Benchley said, "It was one of those plays in which all the actors unfortunately enunciated very clearly." There's something which can be referred to as the speed of life. It's the speed at which life goes, regardless of character. Recently, a friend, a writer of extraordinary talent and skill, had a play of his done off Broadway. He'd traveled a great distance to see his play in performance, but he was shocked to find that the actors seemed to have been directed to feel every line, regardless of the bizarre effect this technique was having on the reality of his play. Now, watching the second performance, he had to leave the show and went down the street to a cafe and got a cup of coffee. He was joined by the director, unexpectedly, shortly thereafter, and asked how he thought the play was going. "Redwoods grow faster," said my friend. The director was profoundly disappointed with my friend that he had not realized that his play was secondary to a process. Sakata Tojiro was asked the following question: "Which is better, the actor who speaks his words quickly or the one who speaks them slowly?" His reply was, "It is said that if a quick one is bad, it is of no consequence. If a slow one is bad, it makes it worse. If there are several actors who are all bad, one can endure one among them who is a fast speaker, but a slow one is a bad actor among bad actors." In review. 1. In communicating, carefully guard against the use of too much facial expression. Technique: gently and consciously suppress use of the face, and what remains will be appropriate. 2. Learn to recognize what is to be featured in communication and what is to be gotten through. Technique: be a good mumbler and get to the point. 3. Speak at the speed of life. How you work must conform to human behavior. Intelligence. Playwright Eugene Ionesco said, "Characters in a play don't always have to be bigger fools than in everyday life." Remember what we said earlier about a good lie needing to be flawless enough to fool us the first time, unless we knew what to look for? My friend was reading for the part of a publicity hound who had two early scenes with the lead. In short, in the first scene, the character portrays herself as an honest, straightforward professional. The second scene is one in which it is revealed that, in fact, she is a headline-grabbing manipulator. Knowing by now to lie well in the first scene, my friend did so. She portrayed the nicest, most genuinely honorable person you'd ever want to meet. The casting director was duly impressed with her reading, but had one problem. "That was very, very good," said the famous casting director, "but can you somehow give us a little something which sort of lets us know that, well, something's a little amiss?" "But wouldn't that be like giving it away?" said my friend, trying to both meet her own standards, get the job, and not insult a highly positioned casting executive. "I don't mean that you should give it away," said the now defensive casting director, "only that maybe there should be a little something in her eyes to, you know, let us know that there's not necessarily something wrong with her, but that there's something maybe a little suspicious about her. Oh, I know what you mean, lied my friend brilliantly. You mean there should just be the slightest glitch in her demeanor so that we think that there's something else coming. Exactly, said the casting director happily. Just so that we'll know that something else is coming. After all, continued the casting director, nobody lies that well. My friend got a call back and went in the next day to read for the producer, director, and writer. Wanting not to offend the casting director, she went ahead against her good judgment and played the part lying rather poorly, allowing just the slightest leak to give it away the first time that her character was lying. That was very good, said the lady producer, hedging, but this time try doing a much better job of lying. After all, continued the producer, the whole pretense should be seamless, shouldn't it? Our whole setup depends upon a credible lie. Right, agreed my friend, not being able to look at the casting director and finding herself in a more difficult position than before. It should be a perfect lie. That's correct, agreed the producer. After all, if for no other reason the lie should be perfect so that the lead, our star, doesn't look like a fool for buying a rotten lie. The lead should be as badly fooled as we are, or she looks stupid. And that could hardly be the intention of the writers, or the lead. Besides, we knew more was coming. It was the beginning of the story. After lying well, she got the part. Quote, after all, nobody lies that well, unquote. This attitude and its ramifications is unfortunate. It comes from a belief which robs the craft of truth, a belief which implies two things, that the characters we play are not necessarily as smart as we are, and that the audience is as unintelligent as the characters that we play. Think of somebody you have considered rather dumb in real life. 95% of the time, if not always, don't they want to appear smart? Don't they try not to appear dumb? Don't they try to appear educated, savvy, knowing, tuned in? Do they desire for you to feel superior to them at their own expense? Of course not. Readily coming to mind is a security guard I know, who is not only undereducated, but clearly has a learning disability. This man not only acts for all the world as smart as Einstein, but, comically enough, goes to the trouble of lining up on his desk all the paperbacks he is currently reading so that you may see how smart he really is. This behavior alone tells you he's not the smartest thing to come down the pike, but one cannot but marvel at the purity, the beauty, and the spirit of humanity which causes him to behave not the way he is, but the way he wants to be, and the way he wants to be perceived. This is not fraud, either in life or in acting. It is the stuff that dreams and desire are made of, and is an integral part of our humanity. And yet, despite daily, if not hourly, examples in life like this, from bag people to millionaires, often, actors insist with predictable frequency to play even police chiefs, thoracic surgeons, lawyers, and Nobel Prize winners as people who have this sort of dumb side to them. This done evidently on the erroneous assumption that to include this idiot quality makes them more human, foibled, vulnerable, and finally more real. In fact, this gross underestimation of what human beings really do makes for utterly laughable and unbelievable portrayals of supposedly intelligent and brilliant people. One of the major components of intelligence in acting is the handling of questions which our characters ask. Remember Robert Redford in Butch Cassidy and the Sundance Kid? The way he kept saying the line, "Who are those guys?" regarding the lawmen who were hunting them down relentlessly? My teacher used to say that in acting there are almost no questions. Think about it. Visualize, if you will, the last thing anyone asked of you that you think was a question. Hear it in your head. Take a moment. Here are some possible examples. How much is the insurance premium going to be? Or, why were you late? Or, when did you find that out? Or, have you looked at those clouds today? Chances are that in no case was a question being asked at all, but rather what was being expressed was the implication of the already known fact that the new premium rate is utterly ridiculous, and that the excuse for being late is no excuse at all, and that this new information absolutely changes everything, and that it looks perilously close to being tornado weather. But in none of them is the question being asked. Rather, a clear communication of the implications involved is being made. Our job, and a wonderful one it is to portray our characters as wanting to be and wanting to appear intelligent even when he isn't. It's exactly this which is the human thing, and it is the human thing for which we actors must be striving. Remember, that which is human is recognizable, and only that which is recognizable can be moving. There are other things which work against intelligence in acting, which can be looked out for in the work. One of them is what can be called the acting of thinking, as though we have to slow down to think. What else are we doing but thinking? We're always thinking. We think in our sleep. And as we've talked about in the looking, what will often be in your eyes when your character is supposedly thinking is a looking into of the implications of what he or she is thinking. Anything from delight when counting cash to looking into your distant future when you're counting your remaining 30 car payments. What we read in the eyes of men are the implications of their thoughts, not the thoughts themselves. Check it out for yourself. Very much along the same line, and another impediment to high intelligence in acting is the acting of seeing. While we may from time to time engage in a show of seeing someone, or a show of surprise, we just see things. We don't act seeing them unless we're intending to communicate for some reason that we do indeed see it. You might pop your head backwards when seeing someone you didn't expect to see in an event as part of a greeting, as a communication for them that their face was not expected by you. But when you see something that you didn't expect to see and are not making a communication about it, what happens is the eyes simply lock in on that thing until you've seen enough, sometimes after a faceless double take. Same is true for hearing. One simply hears, unless it's necessary to communicate that you have indeed heard or that you haven't heard. But here again, we have a fundamental ingredient in acting. As it is true that we are almost never communicating facts or asking questions, but rather communicating the implications of some fact, in the same way when we hear something, what we hear are the implications of what is said. And so we return to the example we started with at the beginning of this chapter. Why did that well-known, experienced casting director want this guest starring part to be just a little dumb? It wasn't for any nefarious reason, I assure you, but for the simple reason that some think that that makes a character more human, vulnerable. The opposite is true. While there may be, from time to time, a few special roles which capture our interest and our hearts, roles where highly emotionally challenged people, those with mental or emotional disabilities, strive to make their way through what can be a very tough world, most of the time we are seeing stories about people who, all dreams being equal, could be us. What we are interested in seeing in stories, and this is true from the ancient epics until the present, are people who have challenges which they either overcome, or who at least move us deeply or make us laugh deeply in their succeeding or failing attempt to overcome. Things which do not move us are sleepiness, lethargy, ennui, boredom, and stupidity, because while those who invest in these lifestyles are entitled, we don't really care what happens to them because they don't know what's happening to them. The only time we identify and are therefore moved by those who do not know what is happening to them is in the case of animals, and as previously stated, those emotionally unequipped to know. No one else has an excuse. In other words, if you can know what's happening to you and you still don't care, nobody else will care. Often you'll hear an actor talk about his or her wanting the character to be really vulnerable, and so they may employ any number of techniques to disenfranchise the character of some degree of wit or sharpness, bravery or mettle. Appearing easily hurt, slowness, not quite getting it, might all be vaguely attractive at times, like someone you want to save, but these attractions usually occur not because they are intrinsically attractive, but because they appeal to a deep guilt within us, a guilt appeased only by momentarily having in the vicinity something a little needy to cuddle. These things must not be mistaken for traits vulnerable. Cary Grant was always vulnerable, but he was never dumb. And if sometimes things were moving around him too quickly for him to get a hold of them, it was never because he was of subpar intelligence. It was simply because things were moving too quickly around him. We wouldn't have laughed if it were because he was slow. Understand that when I use the word vulnerable, it is in the everyday theatrical sense. We're not speaking of the dictionary term of susceptible to attack, but rather to its widely held use as one who is capable of being touched or hurt, and is therefore ostensibly sensitive to others. Vulnerability of a character is created in the audience's mind by the contrast of strength to emotional access. If there is no strength, there is no vulnerability, only weakness. In the literary tradition, characters are vulnerable because they can be moved in spite of their strength, not because they have no strength at all. Well, using this definition, dumb and vulnerable don't make a very good acting team because someone kind of stupid, is always vulnerable, and that means that they are a victim, and even if there's something attractive about them, we really don't care about their story. Vulnerability is much more perceivable in the actions not of a character who's a bit witless, but more so one who wishes not to harm, furthermore one who wishes to aid his world. Vulnerability is not a perceivable trait in a character who is a victim, because they are only vulnerable, and there is nothing with which to compare it. Always play it smart. Don't play figuring out things. Play seeing clearly what things mean, what their implications are. Play seeing the irony and humor in the world around you, and look for where your character has humor, maybe even jokes at his own expense. Think of each and every one of your roles as Einsteins, and let the writing place the dunce cap on them. Then your character will be full and alive, replete with potential and with limitations, rather than with caricaturish tendencies. Portray each character as brilliant. Let the audience discover when they are not. In review. 1. There are no questions to be asked, only communications to be made. 2. Always play it smart. Think of each and every one of your roles as brilliant characters, even if they can say and do things that are not. 3. As previously addressed, if your character lies, he lies well. 4. Vulnerability has meaning when it comes from a position of strength, not weakness. Technique. Play seeing what things mean, what the implications are. Play hearing what things mean, what the implications are. Play speaking what things mean, what the implications are. This is the end of tape 4 of The Impersonal Actor. We'll continue our discussions on tape 5.